And good afternoon. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Cotlin is away today. We have, I'll remind you, last week on the program we interviewed a really remarkable individual because it had to do with the situation in Burkina Faso, and it was the brother of the former revolutionary leader of that country. We spoke to Paul Sankara, and his brother was Thomas Sankara, a very important figure in modern African history. And, of course, Burkina Faso, as you know, has had a dramatic change of government. That is to say, the president, Mr. Compaoré, who attempted to hold on to power, has been asked to go away, and he has. He's in Ivory Coast. We've been fortunate to reach a second individual who is very well informed about matters to do with Burkina Faso, and since it's an unfolding story, we're very glad we could talk to her. It's Joan Baxter. By the way, she has a website. We were able to interview her, Joan Baxter. We did a pre-interview, pre-tape, about on 6 days ago, but it's still, quite timely. And Joan Baxter has a site, joanbaxter.ca. We'll be talking about her website and what she's had to say about this matter of Burkina Faso in her writing. But we're going to begin now with that pre-recorded interview. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. The topic is Burkina Faso, where there has been a tremendous upheaval, and the president has had to stand down, and let's just say he fled the country. And our guest is Joan Baxter, and she's a Canadian journalist, anthropologist, and award-winning author, and she divides her time between Canada and Africa and over the past 30 years. By the way, she has a site, which I really recommend, joanbaxter.com. CA, and she is in Nairobi and joining us now. Are you there, Joan?
I am, Phil. Hi.
Hi. Hey, and let me also say, you have just, you have a book, Dust from Our Eyes, An Unblinkered Look at Africa, and there is a chapter about Burkina Faso in the book. It's called Burying Africa's Hopes, Remembering Thomas Sankara, The Revolution and How Blaise Compaoré Stole It All. And you were there in 1986 and 1988 with the BBC. So we are really pleased because you're as close to this story as anybody that I know of. Give us your first reactions to this news from Burkina Faso.
Well, I think, well, first of all, it was absolutely overwhelming to see the force of the public uprising, which remained, by and large, peaceful. There were deaths because the police opened fire, and there was some looting, but it was just a massive, massive uprising of popular will, and honestly, for me, I have been waiting to see it for 27 years, 2 weeks, and one day. Which was the time between the assassination of President Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso and when his successor, Blaise Compaoré, had to flee the country with the help of the French, I might add.
The French, yes, he has, seems to have many sort of dubious friends in the neighborhood. You know, I'll tell our listeners, and again, please go to the site, joanbaxter.ca, because you actually interviewed both of these celebrated names now from Burkina Faso. You were there at the time of Thomas Sankara, who was assassinated. You interviewed him. You also spoke to Blaise Compaoré. And what is really interesting to me, you interviewed him at a time shortly after the assassination. You were one of the first journalists to approach him to discuss what had happened. Could you talk about that? And of course, I want to contextualize, remind everybody, we've just had this upheaval to remove Blaise Compaoré, and we want to know sort of the thread of the story from the time of Thomas Sankara.
Well, I had been in, we'd actually been in Burkina Faso from about from 1985, 1986, so I got to experience the revolution under Thomas Sankara, and when it began, I have to admit that I was a little bit cynical, skeptical myself, but then the proof was really in the pudding. The man was a true revolutionary. He broke the mold on all fronts. He stood up to the powers that be. I've noticed a lot of people are calling him Che Guevara. I wouldn't call him Che Guevara. I would call him Thomas Sankara. Yeah. He's that big of a revolutionary. Sure. And so the day, I can remember very clearly, we were actually, because it was a Thursday, and that's a day that Tuesdays and Thursdays he expected the civil servants and the population in general to go out late in the afternoon when it wasn't quite so hot and to do sports of any kind, play games, walk, ride a bike, run, whatever you wanted to do. We used to see him on his little bicycle driving around a lake in Ouagadougou. And we were actually dressed to go to that place to do running when people in the neighborhood said to us, don't go there, shooting in town. And then there was a curfew that night, and it wasn't until the next day that we were able to go out, and we found out that actually he had been killed. I went to the graveyard, which I wrote another book about actually called Graveyard for Dreamers, where they had just thrown the 13 bodies in very shallow graves.
You yourself...
The masses turned out.
Yeah, you went to that location where the burial was. They never found the body. Have they actually positively identified the remains of Mr. Sankara?
No, they have not been allowed to actually ever hold a funeral or disinter him and identify the remains. But the 13 bodies were laid in such shallow graves that first morning that you could still see blood in some places. It was done late at night. The bodies were just tossed in the graves from the back of pickup trucks. But already by the next day, the place was strewn with flowers, and there were literally tens of thousands of people there weeping. That was the day after he was assassinated.
And 2 days...
And then there was such an outcry. Yeah, the state of those graves, and we did a lot of reports, and I did a lot of reports for BBC, that finally the African Union put some pressure on President Compaoré, the new president, to do something about those graves. So they put sort of some concrete fixtures on top of the graves, and I was there the day that they were actually nailing the name Thomas Sankara on that grave. But at that point, it was no longer safe to go there. They were discouraging the public from going because President Compaoré didn't want any celebration of Thomas Sankara's life. There has never been a funeral held for him, and there's never been an official investigation, which is why his widow, Mariam Sankara, who now lives in France, immediately started asking for that as soon as Blaise Compaoré fled the country. Finally, we're hoping that there can be a serious investigation into what really happened.
By the way, we interviewed Paul Sankara, one of his brothers, and raised this issue, and I'll raise it with you, the question of now we've had this phenomenon of the downfall of someone who apparently seized power through an assassination and then tried to hold on to power even for his friends for too long. And the question was, can Burkina Faso move forward now without going into the issue of how Compaoré came to power and the death of Sankara? I'd like to know your thoughts.
I think it's going to be very difficult because he's become, 27 years is a long time, and he was an amazing, larger-than-life figure in his lifetime. I'm not sure that somebody who espouses the things that he espoused today will be accepted, because with neoliberalism and globalization, there just isn't the chance for somebody like that to come to power. The powers that be are not going to want that to happen. Mm-hmm. And Burkina Faso has become, under Blaise Compaoré, a real military stronghold for the Americans, who have drones there, and the French. And that's in a very unstable region since Gaddafi was overthrown and killed. Mali became a scene of conflict. Niger is a scene of conflict. So the Americans and the French are kind of trying to keep a hold.
The wind is blowing. The political winds have been blowing the other direction. As we find the French back in Mali, the British to Sierra Leone. This individual Sankara, one of his topics, popular one, was neocolonialism. I assume that in that context, that expression is probably popular, that because we seem to be seeing the French, particularly, seemed very arrogant about their right to interfere in West African affairs.
Well, I think the French are often more blatant about it than the Americans are. But to be honest, the Americans are in every
more hands on
in West Africa. and maybe they're not quite as honest about it, but even in Mali, long before the Troubles were there, when I was in Mali in the late 1990s and early 2000s, they definitely were in northern Mali. Their presence has been there for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So the kind of the geopolitical games that are played in West Africa and have been since independence are exactly as Thomas Sankara described them. It is imperialism and neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that he used to say that rankled them so much is that he wanted true independence and down with imperialism. Mm-hmm. And he really called, when I interviewed him a few months before he was killed, and I asked him, why are you using all these slogans? They get really tiresome, you know, la patrie ou la mort, nous vaincons, fatherland or death. We will win. And he said, look, if you've got a cancer, you have to call it a cancer. Mm-hmm. So that was what he had no fear of standing up and calling the bluff and calling the game for what it was, which is why in the end,
yes,
it seems that almost anybody who does that in Africa doesn't have a very long life.
Hey, by the way, the name Lumumba comes to mind, and particularly sort of the political circumstances, because many years after the death of Lumumba, we have many people who say, well, I represent Lumumba's thought, but it's very hard to reconnect. I want to ask you about this. I mean, the crowds I was seeing, I don't, of course, understand the language, and I'm watching all kinds of material that's available on the internet, and it's very inspiring, actually, to see the crowds. But none of the mm-hmm. political leaders are sort of speaking to the period of 83 to 87, but the people are. I see them holding up photographs of Sankara and all that. What do you see, and you must be following closely, trends here in terms of who might come to the fore and what the people are going to expect to happen now that Compaoré has been removed?
I think the uprising in Burkina Faso shook a lot of powers that be in Africa. You know, we talked always about the Arab Spring, which in fact started out as a North African Spring, mm-hmm. when there were the uprisings in Tunisia and in Egypt, and then, of course, what looked like a fairly orchestrated one in Libya. But the rest of Africa itself has been quite quiet. Relatively quiet. There have been, you know, there are a lot of ongoing conflicts, mm-hmm. but there hasn't been these mass uprisings where they were successful in chasing out an unpopular mm-hmm. leader who had overstayed his welcome, if indeed he ever had one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he shook a lot of people on the continent, and he also shook, you know, the whole geopolitical game, because these people who kind of considered that, you know, Blaise Compaoré a stalwart, he had started to be, instead of being remembered as an assassin or somebody who orchestrated an assassination, he started being recognized and being promoted by the French and by the Americans as a great statesman and as a peacemaker in West Africa. He was brought in to mediate when there were problems in Guinea and so on. So I think they've all been shaken up. And they're looking very carefully at how they can keep some control over the situation without letting it get out of hand and have another true revolution on their hands.
Yeah, this is they're in a delicate situation. He was certainly accused, and I know that Paul Sankara spoke of this, his involvement in Ivory Coast, where he apparently armed elements against Mr. Gbagbo and did it fairly blatantly, I guess.
Well, he was certainly an ally of the current president of Ivory Coast.
Yeah, and that's where he is, right?
He's, and his wife. If you go, you always, you know, this is why Africans really like to look at history, because, and I think often in the West we forget to look at history and kind of trace things back, and especially in the media we tend to see events in isolation and don't look at the context.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look, for example, when Thomas Sankara came to power in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
There were four of them, and they were revolutionaries, and Blaise Compaoré was with him.
Yes.
And they were called the Gang of Four. Now, what happened is that the dean, what they call the dean of West Africa, a really close ally of France, President Hofwe Boigné in Ivory Coast, was very much against Thomas Sankara and the revolution. He was very, very conservative. He maintained relations with apartheid South Africa. He let French people basically run his country. And he was, of course, very frightened about what was happening in Burkina Faso. So in a very, you know, almost Shakespearean way, he found a wife for president, for Blaise Compaoré, who is Ivorian and related to him. So his wife is actually Ivorian. So it makes sense that he would flee to her family home. Yeah, and
it is Shakespearean.
I think it would be very interesting to trace and see where, you know, some of the money went as well when the presidents leave the country.
But it is a very the personal drama is quite something. And by the way, your book, Dust from Our Eyes, An Unblinkered Look at Africa, and the chapter, which is at joanbaxter.ca, you give us a lot of interesting details about the relationships. And you, there's a clue there that I wanted to ask you on this matter of the relationship between Compaoré and Thomas Sankara. The widow said that they had made up. She said they, you know, the night before he was assassinated, the two of them were talking like schoolboys, and
yeah.
And but do you know what made up over what? Was Sankara aware of something really different in the opinion of Mr. Compaoré at that time? Do you know what that was?
Yeah, I think in the last year or so of his life, I think there had been a lot of tension building, and possibly it had a lot to do with Blaise Compaoré's new allegiances, close relationships with Ivory Coast and Hofwe Boigné, who, by the way, in 1985 tried to destabilize the government of Thomas Sankara by giving the president of Mali $1 million to wage war on Burkina Faso. That was actually the ex-president of Mali said that in a courtroom when I was present, so it's not a rumor. So I think that there had been efforts to destabilize Thomas Sankara, and there were rumors, certainly were rife 6 months before the coup in October, that there was a lot of tension and that something was going to give. So that's why everybody was very on edge. The night before the coup, afterwards, Mariam said to me that she just, what made it even more difficult for her to reconcile is that Blaise had been there till late in the night, and that they had been together and laughing like schoolboys again, and she thought that they were, any of the rifts that were there were healed.
Oh,
which is why it was so incredibly difficult to accept what happened the next day. Now, of course, Blaise Compaoré denied to me, I saw him the day after the coup, he said he had been sick, he said that he had nothing to do with it, he thought that his life was in danger, there had been a coup mounted against him, and he had even run out when he heard the shooting in his underwear, shooting because he was sick. But then in the long run, all of those stories started to look
more like,
and that he had never wanted to be president, and yet, you know, he didn't want to be president, but he stayed for 27
then he, didn't want to be anything else.
Yeah.
But also, of course, he'd never identified the killers and never prosecuted anybody and threw dirt on the graves. It is an amazing story. I've got to ask you about this aspect. There are big mining companies there, aren't there? Gold mining companies from Canada. I noticed some reports just before he fled the country that they were talking about some concern that the mines were being shut down by strikers and such. Do you know anything about that? And how much what sort of minerals are being mined there, and who's got them?
Well, Canada has very, very, very big mining interests in Niger, in gold. Uranium is mined in the north of Niger. That was always the famous uranium that was supposed to be going to for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but that's being mined by the French. And Canada has gold mines in Niger. It has a lot of gold mines in Burkina Faso and a lot of gold mines in Mali and also in Guinea.
Mm.
And IAM Gold is one of the biggest Canadian concerns. They have large mines mm-hmm. in Burkina Faso and in Mali, and they have big interests. And a lot of Canada's foreign policy in that area has been focused on that. For example, just before the Harper government dissolved the Canadian International Development Agency and rolled it into the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, CETA grant gave $500 million to three Canadian NGOs to do corporate social responsibility for three Canadian mining companies, one in Ghana, one in Colombia, and indeed IAM Gold in Burkina Faso.
Uh-huh.
So the mining companies are not just there getting gold, but they're also getting support from Canadian taxpayers.
Yeah. Well, and no doubt Burkina Faso taxpayers, I'm sure any resource-rich country is very. The population wants to know who's making money out of this and how much are people getting. Was there a change of policy, a clear one on such things as minerals? I guess when Sankara came in and also when he died, has there been a? Could you talk about
the mine? The mining had not really got off the ground to the extent that it has. You know, it was really in the 1980s and the 90s, you know, in the real golden, if you want to call it golden, age of globalization and neoliberalism, when the World Bank was really promoting foreign investment and setting up these investment promotion agencies throughout Africa, which were really... basically, it was kind of a race to the bottom. All the small, impoverished countries in West Africa, like Burkina Faso and Mali and Sierra Leone and Guinea, were all trying to outdo each other in the advantages that they were giving to the foreign investors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they will allow 100% foreign ownership, 100% for ownership, 100% expatriation of profits, tax holidays from 10 to 30 years. So they've been, the governments have been pushed into doing this, and really what has been happening is that the only real revenues they get is a minuscule amount of tax from the very poorly paid workers who work in these mines.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been, I mean, strikes are very, very common, and I can't speak about from personal experience in Burkina Faso, but I know of strikes at Canadian gold mines in Niger, and I know of strikes at gold mines in Mali. So you know, there are a lot of hard feelings, and indeed all over Africa, there's a feeling that they're not getting anything for their resources. That the resources are indeed continue to be a curse rather than a blessing.
Yeah, one assumes that that in the present situation, these matters are going to be eventually come to the fore after they sort out the matter, a question of elections and whatnot. By the way, I would make it clear we're speaking to Joan Baxter, author of Dust from Our Eyes, An Unblinkered Look at Africa. And at her site, it's joanbaxter.ca. There is a chapter from Dust from Our Eyes describing the situation, the story of Burkina Faso, contemporary story, in particular focusing on Thomas Sankara. You must be thinking about going there for a visit. You've been awfully close to this story.
I was there in June for a completely different issue, and I will probably be going back because I'm working with a research organization that actually has an office there, and we're working on environmental issues in the country. So, in fact, I'm in touch every day with people in Burkina Faso. In fact, the hotel that I stayed in when I was there in June was destroyed in the uprising last week.
Really?
Allegedly, it was run by very corrupt people, and it looks as if the population knows very well who's corrupt and who isn't, because they targeted very closely what it was that they went after you know, in the days that they were demonstrating.
Mm-hmm. And I we didn't list all these things, but I want to make sure we cover again some of the from your chapter about Thomas Sankara. I could say, by the way, that I was in Ouagadougou some years ago, and I was so struck by the I had come from a country where women were definitely marginalized, and you didn't see them, like, for example, on scooters or motorcycles. And I got to Burkina Faso, and here was all these women racing up and down the street on their motorcycles. And somebody said, I said, how come it's that way here? And they just, one simple answer, they said Sankara. He made strides that Mr. Compaoré couldn't turn around. He couldn't reverse these things that were accomplished. Could you talk about some of the things that happened to the population as a result of, like, focusing, say, on women, what happened with them under Sankara?
Yeah, in so many ways, as one of his ministers said to me afterwards, he said, you know, I'm not sure I think he was a messiah. He was so far ahead of his time. You know, he was very, very human, but there was nothing he wouldn't tackle, and he wanted to change overnight. And one of the things, he never had a written speech. You know, staying on the message for him, that didn't exist. It was mm-hmm. refreshingly open and brilliant orator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the International Women's Day, he would make a speech and lambaste the men in his country for treating their wives like worse than their animals, and saying, you know, you're all born of women. And he was a feminist par excellence before anybody in Africa had even thought about feminism, really. Mm-hmm. And so the women of the country started to wear scarves for the revolution, which you still see them wear today, which have doves on them. Uh-huh. And he would form women's groups and support the women's group. He had a ministry for women's affairs. Mm-hmm. He had women ministers when nobody else would think about having women ministers. Mm-hmm. To tackle prostitution, he said that the prostitutes, because many of the sex workers were unfortunate young women who came from neighboring countries where there was not a hard currency. The CFA franc in Burkina Faso is tied to the European currency now. At that time, it was tied to the French franc. So it wasn't in free fall. Mm-hmm. So you would find young women coming up from Ghana who had no choice but to go work in a restaurant, and then they didn't get paid, so then they wound up trying to make ends meet by working as unwilling sex workers. And he said that was wrong, and he said, we're going to put them to work. And he opened up these state bars and all these little green corners. He insisted every neighborhood in the city should have a little green restaurant where it was a garden. And he was offering jobs to
all
these
former sex workers.
And they did
do that. Those gardens were established.
And they did that.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he was, before the word locavore even existed, I think he may have been the first locavore on the planet, he said, let's eat what we consume, let's produce what we consume what we produce.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we're going to ban the importation of apples, which are ridiculous. They're a temptation to make yourself think that you're a French person. We've got so much indigenous fruit that lies here rotting that people look down on because it's not a fruit that rich people eat. So he was a true revolutionary in every way, and he didn't sleep.
Yeah.
The people who worked with him said he was a nightmare to work with because he hated sloth. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. He was a fitness fanatic. When President Mitterrand came from France in his Concorde jet to visit, he served him local fare. He served him local sorghum beer. I mean,
and asked him some embarrassing questions.
It was unheard of.
Yeah. And by the way.
Yeah, and then he stood up and criticized him openly for allowing apartheid leaders to put their feet on French soil.
Oh, that was. I really like those stories. By the way, that's in at joanbaxter.ca. You can read the chapter discussing these. I have to ask you about what the American ambassador called potato sacks, the shirts. How do you say that? It's a faso d'enfani?
Faso d'enfani. You see, Thomas Sankara's country, when he came to power, it was called Upper Volta. The Volta River is a river system that runs through West Africa. So, the French, when they carved off this part of their Sudanese colony, they just called it Upper Volta. He changed in Thomas Sankara, on the anniversary, the first anniversary of the revolution, changed the name to Burkina Faso, which means land of upright people or land of dignified people in two languages. So Faso Dan Fani is the name of locally grown cloth. They grow cotton in the Sahelian countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, but most of it was grown and exported raw, no value adding at all. And then they would import cotton back into the country. So he said, no, why are we not weaving our own, processing and weaving our own cotton? So that's what he decided they were going to do. They called it Faso Dan Fani, and civil servants were supposed to wear Faso Dan Fani to work. And anybody who was coming to visit the presidential office had to wear Faso Dan Fani. When I interviewed Thomas Sankara, I always wore Faso Dan Fani.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I even found myself in the same color and the same weave as he was wearing, which was quite funny. And today, the cloth still exists. It's haute couture, and they've developed it into really beautiful, beautiful patterns. It's amazing textile.
Well, okay.
That's all his legacy.
I want one of those.
Now, what happened is that this is a raw cotton, can only be woven in certain length strips, so it's sewn together, and it can be very beautiful. But I asked the American ambassador, because I had heard a story that his driver had gone to deliver a letter to the presidential office, and he was not wearing Faso Dan Fani, he was wearing a uniform from the American embassy, and that he was stopped at the gate and he wasn't allowed to go in with the vehicle because he was not wearing Faso Dan Fani. So when I asked the ambassador if this was true, he didn't confirm or deny it, but he said, nobody who works for me will ever dress in a potato sack. Which gives you a fair idea of how disparaging and paternalistic and condescending so many people still can be when they come out to us.
You also had an interview with the U.S. ambassador, and he was quite candid with you. On the one hand, he told you he liked and admired Thomas Sankara, but then he became rather firm on the subject where you were talking about his policies. And could you tell that story?
Yeah, actually, I invited him to come over for dinner one night, trying to sort of find out where he really stood on things. Mm-hmm. And he was actually, he had been pulled out of retirement by Ronald Reagan. And in his own words, he had been sent to Burkina Faso to straighten Thomas Sankara out. And he said his surprise was that he really liked him. He said he liked him like a son. He was a true revolutionary in that he was trying to overturn the very hierarchical kind of feudal system that existed with some of the traditional leaders and so on, and give women their rights, and he approved of all those things. But then he took his fist and he hammered on the end of my table and made everything shake.
Really?
And said, but we're not going to have another Cuba in Africa. And 2 months later, that ambassador, Leonardo Nea, left the country just before the coup. Thomas Sankara.
By the way, that's again why it's very important. I hope people go to joanbaxter.ca, read all this, because it's such a it's kind of like the mob in the movies where they say it's nothing personal. I mean, on the one hand, here he is telling you he likes him, but then the rather blood curdling change of mood, you might say, where it's strictly business and they want to get rid of him. Now, speaking to Joan Baxter, by the way, the book is Dust from Our Eyes, An Unblinkered Look at Africa. Joan is a Canadian journalist and anthropologist and an award-winning author, and she divides her time between Canada and Africa. On the last matter, yesterday or the day before, the OAU started issuing strange statements about the situation in Burkina Faso, and they told the military men who had assumed power, you have to turn it over in two days. You have to give power to civilians. And they even sent someone to sit down with the new commander there, whose name escapes me. When we spoke to Paul Sankara, he said they never said that to Blaise. Campari. He said he was there for 27 years. Nobody gave him 24 hours. But I suppose this is going to become a concern, because if there's going to be an argument about what kind of government and who will lead, we're going to be hearing these little rumbles from Paris and London, Washington, and I guess the AOAU, as though they have a right to determine what's going to take place here. I'd like to know your thoughts about that.
Yeah. Oh, boy, that's a big one. First of all,
I meant it to be a big
one. I don't think many. The simple thing, you know, since the time of the Cold War, mm-hmm. We only dislike dictators if they're not our dictators. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it comes down to. And so we're extremely quiet in the West. And so, the AU, it's quite funny that coming from the AU, because if you actually go around and look at some of those presidents, Museveni from Uganda, Kabila in DR Congo, the list is long. They all came, mm-hmm. they were all former military people, and they all came to power in coups.
Mm-hmm.
But now suddenly they feel that they have the right to pronounce on what goes on in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the West, as I say, they're very, very quiet about the president of Equatorial Guinea, because that's a very important source of oil for the West, mm-hmm. and incredibly tolerant of some very anti-democratic regimes in Africa, mm-hmm. whereas they pick and choose which ones they want to criticize. It depends on how much cooperation they get from them when it comes to, you know, looking after their and protecting their investments and, you know, allowing them military bases and so on. Having said that, I also want to say that I would hate to see another ruthless military regime mm-hmm. take over and stay there indefinitely and then, you know, pretend to transform itself into a civilian government.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the importance of making it clear that the military have got to hand over and we have to go through a transition with a truly independent electoral commission.
Mm-hmm.
and get a civilian government back in power. That's mm-hmm. absolutely essential, and I understand why they would do it. Coming from the AU, it can be sound quite hypocritical, and 2 weeks, which I think was the deadline, I think is ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply way too fast. You need time for a transition. You need to get ready for
it. And it would give certain advantages to people who built little power bases over these 27 years. Now they need a level playing field. And one other matter I want to touch on before we go. This is a sophisticated political culture in Burkina Faso, isn't it? I know I've spoken to some people from Africa who study these things, and they say that in a way they were surprised, because they say this is a population that doesn't act out that often. You know, that there's a lot of politics in Burkina Faso. Is that how you would characterize them?
I would say that if you look at most of the Sahelian countries in particular, they have long histories of trade unionism that go back way back.
Mm-hmm.
They have very sophisticated social and political structures that go way back.
Uh-huh.
So to be surprised that they would be politically savvy and sophisticated, I think, again, is really unfair and, mm-hmm. and biased, because, you know, if you look at the Mali Empire, which is back in the 1300s, it was a remarkable hegemony in West Africa with a constitution and all sorts of democratic principles.
Mm-hmm.
So democracy in an...
Yeah, they're not unfamiliar with it.
They're not new to this area.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, the civil society group that you find throughout the Sahelian countries, and I would say throughout West Africa, actually, except in countries that have been decimated by conflict, very often the civil society groups reflect indigenous groups within a society. You know, there are very strong women's organizations, very strong men's groups, very strong youth groups,
mm-hmm.
very strong communal... people are much... work much better together than they do as individuals. They're still very much group-oriented. So when something happens, I have to say the tolerance for injustice and hardship is so amazing mm-hmm. to me as a Canadian. I mean, well, you know, I've seen people get more upset when, you know, they can't go through a drive-thru at Tim Hortons than people do in West Africa when they don't have any water. But having said that, too, when they start to mobilize, when the time is ripe, no leader can stand up to them. It happened in Mali, and it happened in Mali in 1991, and at that point it was led by women who stood up to a dictator. And when the police opened fire on that group, it was women and students. When they opened fire, then that was it for the regime. It collapsed. So I think they have a very strong political culture. They have very strong internal groups and solidarity that help these kinds of things get mobilized. When they start happening, boy, they happen fast, as everybody saw in Burkina. And they have a long fuse, 27 years. And it's not that there haven't been demonstrations before, but they have been brutally brought down and people have been killed. But this time it was just en masse. And it was the end for the regime of Blaise Compaoré.
Well, I tell you, you make us very, very hopeful for the land of upright people. We've been speaking to Joan Baxter, but it's joanbaxter.ca. I really urge people to go to that site. Joan, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you very much, Phil. Lovely to talk to you.
Nice talking to you. Bye-bye. And this is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM.